Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
We spoke to Paul Roberts over a year ago about the peak oil crisis, the growing global concern about dwindling oil supplies. His book then was called The End of Oil. Well, now Paul Roberts has written a new book, disturbingly called The End of Food. He joins us now to talk about it. Paul, welcome to Open House again.
It's good to be back. Thanks.
We are hearing more and more reports of the global food crisis, particularly hitting poor countries, Haiti, the Philippines, Mexico, places like that. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, that's one level, and that's certainly the sort of the characteristic that people are focusing on now. Food prices higher, and that's tough for wealthy countries, and it's disastrous in countries where, you know, food expense takes up such a large share of household income. So that is what's catching attention now. But, you know, I began writing the book before prices had really gone up. In fact, at the time that I began writing, the problem was that food was too cheap. Hmm. We had, heavily subsidized farm production in the developed countries, flooding the markets with overly cheap grain and with all kinds of ramifications ranging from obesity to really making it hard for farmers in poor countries to compete. So we still have some of those problems, but on top of that, we have a food crisis in the traditional sense, in that people can't get enough to eat.
Well, the World Bank actually talks about 33 countries having some sort of crisis on their hands due to the soaring price of basic foods. And is it true that China and India are already planning ahead for tightened food supplies for their countries?
Right, and China and India, China in particular, has always had a skeptical eye. It's always been suspicious of markets generally. It doesn't like turning over things like food security or energy security to the global trading system. It believes that world markets can be manipulated, which they can, and that they're susceptible to politics, which they are. And so, as it did with oil, where China began locking in participation in overseas oil fields, China has begun sort of locking in access to food supply. And it's doing that in a couple of ways. One is it's invested heavily in places like Brazil, which is a big soybean exporter. It's also invested in research to develop particular varieties of soybean that work best in the Chinese market. And that sort of tied Brazil to China. And the other thing that China has done is it's begun buying up foreign farmland. This is a fairly recent development, but Beijing has sort of authorized big Chinese agricultural companies to make purchases of foreign farmland with the idea that they will be able to control the output on that farmland and send it back to the mainland and back to China.
So you see these big countries like China then starting to, I guess, jockey for position to, ensure that they're going to have supplies for their citizens in the future. How has it come to this? What's led to this?
Well, that is the question, because up until recently, if you and I were having this conversation even 2 years ago, the question would have been, we've got too much food, and really the issue again is dealing with all this excess. Now we're in a particular situation, and a couple of things have happened. First of all, there are things like, well, there's drought, which you're quite familiar with. Mm. That's really hurt output in some of the key exporting countries, Australia being one, but certainly a part of Eastern Europe. Canada is suffering some natural sort of weather-related crop problems. We've had huge flooding in the American Midwest. So we've got these natural disasters. But you combine that with sort of political disasters, like the whole biofuel initiative, reconverting sort of land that had been growing crops for food and re-sort of distributing that into fuel has really put a pinch on supplies of grain. Far more than many of the biofuels proponents claimed it would. I think they believed, a few years ago that it was sort of a win-win. Here we had excess of grain and we had oil prices that were too high, so Let's turn that excess into fuel. And it's turned out that it was probably not a good idea. Mm. So those are the short-term things. I think the long-term thing, though, and this is really the disturbing part, because biofuels, that can be changed. That's political and that can be fixed. The disturbing part that's going to be much harder to address is the fact that populations are getting not only bigger but richer. And richer populations eat more resource intensively, particularly in terms of meat. Meat, I'm sure you've heard this ratio, but it takes 8 pounds of grain to make a single pound of meat. Mm. So as our diets change and become more carnivorous, our grain demand, our demand for grain, and therefore for the land to grow the grain, goes up geometrically. And that's really what we have to keep our eye on.
Yes. Paul Roberts is with us. Theopenhouse.net.au has the podcast. We're talking about the end of food. Paul, I want to talk about how that's going to affect developed countries like yours and ours in just a few minutes. But If you can just flesh that out, that last point out a little bit more about the fact that it seems that we struggle in the developed world with obesity on the one hand, and yet poverty and scarcity of food in developing countries on the other. What kind of figures do you have behind you, I guess, when it comes to that ratio, that disparity then between the developed world and developing world when it comes to food consumption?
Well, what's interesting here is that we do have roughly 1 billion people who are malnourished on the planet and roughly 1 billion people who are overnourished, to use the politically correct term for being overweight or obese. Now, if you took someone from 100 years ago and you brought them forward and said, look here, we've got a sixth of our population is overweight and a sixth is malnourished, they would say, why are you complaining? That is so fantastically better than things have been for most of human history that really you should be congratulating yourself. So really, it's, from a historical perspective, we're doing quite well. It's only in the last 100 years when we expected to be, completely eliminating hunger that we really realize that we're failing. Now, part of the problem is that up until recently, food has been very cheap, so it wasn't so much the number of calories worldwide. It was the fact that we weren't able to get them always to the people who needed them. So, for example, we had countries where the politics were so unstable that you couldn't guarantee food shipments, or the roads were so bad. Well, the people were simply too poor to buy the food. The food was there. They simply couldn't afford it. That was sort of the political problem when it came to hunger, and that was sort of the target that a lot of aid groups really aimed at when they were trying to cure hunger, was dealing with these political obstacles. Well, those political obstacles are still there. It is still politically hard to get food to the people that need it. Roads are still bad. People are still poor. But on top of that now, we have this scarcity. And if you go back then to the time when food was very cheap, it was so cheap that the people that could afford it or did have good roads or did have good stores like we do here in the developed world were getting too much food, and that's where you got your obesity. So you have this world in which you have a lot of people who are getting too much and a declining number, but still an important number, who aren't getting enough. And then suddenly you switch to where globally there's not enough food. Yeah. You have all these historical problems compounded by this new scarcity.
Okay, so it's going to be particularly tough for developing countries. Now, where does that leave countries like yours, the United States, and ours, Australia, and other developed world countries?
Well, we've got a couple of challenges. We have to deal with, the United States is the world's one of the world's top exporters when it comes to food, and the rest of the world relies on us, and particularly relies on our surpluses and our ability to sort of continuously generate those surpluses. So we have a role worldwide. We're not really sure how we're going to address if we continue doing things like biofuels. Do we want to continue to produce biofuels, or do we want to tamp that back and go back to producing food? Longer term, I think the question for a developed country is how to maintain the curve of output. Over the last century, we've seen some fantastic improvements in output in bushels per acre, and now we're starting to see that slow down. And so one question is, why is that slowing down? The other question is, what can we do to reverse that? And there are certainly some who say, well, the answer is we'll use genetic engineering to sort of restart that great yield curve. But there's a lot of doubts about that. Mm. And I think at the same time, people are asking, well, isn't the real problem here demand? And isn't demand really being driven by this sort of unsustainable meat-heavy diet? And isn't that where we should focus on?
What about, though, our own food scarcity? Could it actually become in the future difficult for us to actually find food ourselves?
Well, the advantage that the developed world has, it has a huge quantity of grain sort of locked up in its diet. I mean, if you keep in mind that meat, that each pound of meat represents 8 pounds of grain, then the massive amount of meat that we consume in places like the United States and Canada and Europe and Australia and increasingly in Japan, that represents a massive amount of grain that sort of could be released were we to reduce our meat intake somewhat. And so that's an option that we have, a certain flexibility, some slack in the system, if you will. I don't foresee a huge die-off. All things being equal, I see that we're going to have to, that as prices rise, diets will change, meat will become harder to afford, even in richer countries, and that will free up some grain.
So, Paul, what does that mean? What should we be doing then to start counteracting this, this trend of a decline in food that certainly seems to be going to affect the developing world more than us?
Well, I guess it's two-track. I mean, the United States, and I'll speak from the United States, and there's probably some examples to be drawn from other countries, developed countries, but, we're going to have to rethink our foreign aid policy. What is it that we're trying to help these poor, hungry countries do? you know, traditionally we've suggested that the best thing for them to do is import more of our grain. And we're realizing now that that may have been a fairly weak policy in the sense that it leaves them vulnerable to price spikes such as the ones we're experiencing now. So, you know, we've spent about 30 years sort of denigrating the notion of self-sufficiency, that countries should try to produce their own food. I don't think we can go back to a time when countries do produce their own food. We're already past that point, particularly in places like China and India. They're just simply too big and too populous. However, I think emphasizing more local production, more home production, has to be the way to go. So that's one issue, and that takes place at a sort of a federal level. I think the other thing, though, is a recognition on the part of the consumers that they've got to change, that we've got to change the way we eat. You know, certainly people are recognizing, again, in the United States, that the food supply they sort of took for granted is now to be looked at with some suspicion in terms of food safety, in terms of the nutritional content, in terms of the sustainability. And I think that consumers in this country are waking up and asking, if the food system isn't quite as sustainable or safe as I thought it was, what do I do? And I think you're seeing a lot of people turning more to local food production.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, turning back to cooking. I don't want to be, you know, Martha Stewart here, but what's critical, I think, is that up until recently, we cooked a lot in this country, and cooking was the... By cooking, we sort of... That was a point of control over the food that came into the household. And you're minding the quality and the price. We don't do that anymore. We've outsourced the whole cooking function to an industry that we're now beginning to realize isn't quite as smart or as sustainable or as safe as we thought it was.
Yes. Paul, I hate to pick on your country, but when I was in the U.S. earlier in the year, I traveled between Peru, Dominican Republic, Haiti, and then the U.S., and it was so interesting to walk into, say, a Burger King in Peru and find that you could get small sizes and small burgers, and then walk into one in LAX, the airport, and find that there was no small size. It started off with, I think it was medium, then large, then jumbo or super or something like that. There simply was no small size. I think it's not in any way, I guess, limited to your country, but...
We definitely pioneered the notion that value equates to size when
yes.
it comes to food servings. And if you think about it, you know, food was so cheap for so long that the way to sort of add value and to convince consumers they were getting a better deal was to make a bigger serving. And really, the only way to sort of experience that added value as a consumer is to eat it.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, and that the industry claims that large serving sizes don't encourage overeating, but this has been, you know, shown to be untrue time and time again in research.
Yeah.
You present even a kid of anywhere over 3 or 4 with a larger serving, they will eat more. Now, what's interesting is children under 3, I believe, presented different serving sizes, will eat the same amount regardless. In other words, they have an internal sort of a system that says, this is how much I need. But it's after a certain age they begin responding to the cue that the serving size provides. And the suspicion is that by that point, we're already more susceptible to the signals we're getting from our culture as to how much is enough to eat.
Right.
And certainly serving size is a strong signal. Keep that in mind the next time you dish up.
Yes. So, Paul, where does this leave the fast food industry then? What's going to happen with them when it comes to, you know, the food scarcity that we might see ahead?
I think that if they're smart, they'll do two things. They'll continue to offer food cheaply, but they'll try to find a way to do it that is perceived as being more nutritious and just better for us and more sustainable. Whether they'll be able to pull that off we'll have to wait to see.
Yes. We'll wait. Oh, I'm getting a bit cheeky here now, but Paul, I think we'll have to wait to see if the small size starts appearing in U.S. Burger King outlets again.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that I'm sure you've seen in clothing sizes, what used to be a sort of a large is now a medium, because that's to make the consumer feel like it's not them that's getting bigger, you know.
Yes.
And I think that you'll see the same thing with food sizes. What used to be a large is probably going to be a medium. So who knows? We'll have to wait and see.
We will. Paul, thanks for your time again.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Yeah, good to talk to you. Paul Roberts there, the author of The End of Oil. We spoke to him about that topic last year, and this topic is based around his new book, The End of Food.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.